Good morning and welcome to Jump in Tucson. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley, and with me as a co-host today is Sixto Molina. Good morning, Sixto.
Good morning, Dr. Ed.
Well, you and I like to eat. We like to go places and have good food and talk and have a good experience. And I've been teaching down at the U of A for 33 years now, almost 34, and have had a lot of good experience at the University of Arizona Dining. I was just at one of their fine restaurants just the other day with a group of people celebrating someone's promotion. It was great. So we are speaking this segment with Christine Carlson, who happens to be the Director of Dining and Nutrition at the University of Arizona Student Union. So how are you doing, Christine?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. So before we get talking about the University of Arizona Student Union and all the wonderful things that are going on there, let's talk a little bit about Christine. So how did you, what's your trajectory? How did you become a person that is knows something a little bit about dining and nutrition, and how did you get to the University of Arizona?
Yeah, so I started about 10 years ago. I started as assistant director for nutrition. I'm actually a registered dietitian. Mm-hmm. And so I was the first ever registered dietitian to work in dining. And so kind of had a blank canvas, grew a lot of different programming and continued to grow. I now oversee all of the dining concepts on campus. So over 30 restaurants on campus, as well as the dining nutrition efforts that we have.
What I've noticed over the last 30 plus years is the kind of metamorphosis of what the offerings are from maybe back many years ago, maybe a little bit more of a fast foodish kind of an approach to things, to where now it's pretty obvious that there is a pretty big focus on health and nutrition and feeding students well so that they can go navigate through the academic process in a powerful way.
Yes, we're always looking to see what's trending, what students are looking for, and we have that ability to kind of flip menus or restaurants around to create those experiences that students are looking for.
I've also noticed that the students themselves are a lot more focused on their own health, you know, with the big rec center and the physical fitness focus that they have, but also just in the classroom itself, you know, maybe 25, 30 years ago, they'd come in. Of course, they didn't have those beautiful water bottles that they have now, but they would come in and they would have, you know, a soft drink or something. But now they come in many times, they've got water in there, and they are heading to the workout place afterwards. And even over at the Honors College, there's a big workout facility that they've put in, and there's a lot more focus on physical fitness and health and nutritional fitness as well.
Yes, I've definitely noticed that as well. We actually, you mentioned physical fitness. We created a program several years ago called Eat Like a Champ. And CHAMP is an acronym that stands for carbohydrate, hydration, anti-inflammatory, mental focus, and protein. And the idea behind it is that we're training students to kind of try and eat the full CHAMP. Each letter has foods that have mm-hmm. those functions. And we created different things like the CHAMP smoothie that's available at IQ Fresh in the Student Union Food Court. We have CHAMP bars available at Enrich Urban Market. But then we also talk to students about, you know, kind of what they're up to. They might choose different letters. So if they're an endurance athlete, they might be looking more at C and H, carbohydrate and hydration. If they're mm-hmm. injured, they might be looking more at anti-inflammatory or protein. Or if they're having trouble, you know, concentrating in the classroom, they might focus more on the mental focus.
Right. You know, I'd even notice this in the the vending machines that just as a general rule, the vending machines that are, you know, made available to students and faculty and staff. You know, again, 30 years ago, they would be chock full of sugary products and pick-me-ups kind of thing. But now, even the vending machines, well over half of them are more nutritional and focus, or whatever you would say, nutritional, I guess. And then even the drinks that you can get out of the vending machines, not all of them are necessarily sugary products. There's a lot of other options, waters and other things
that are
available.
And we work with those companies to request those types of things, and they're very interested in making sure that they're giving the students what they want.
You know, we'll talk a little bit about the different things that you do at the Student Union, but when Scott Button was there several years ago, at one point he said that that the University of Arizona is one of the biggest purveyors of daily meals for food in the state of Arizona. And that comes mainly because there's so many locations of the University of Arizona as a land-grant institution with locations all over the state of Arizona, you know, whether it be a farm up in the Four Corners area or wherever. There's a lot of food service facilities that the University of Arizona oversees, which you folks oversee most of those. It's a pretty daunting task every day to feed as many people as you feed.
Yeah, we probably serve about 5 million meals a year.
That's amazing.
And it obviously takes a lot of people to do that. So we do have a production kitchen, we have a central warehouse, and we have a lot of staff, obviously. We have our chefs, our cooks, our managers, sanitation, warehouse help as well, just to make sure all of that happens. We have, we're the largest employer of students on the university campus. And a lot of, you know, one of the things we really like to do is try and offer an experiential learning for students. So students have the option to grow into student lead positions where they are kind of the person in charge during some off hour times. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite things is that we have some students that are interested in growing with us and becoming career staff. And so we have students that are still attending classes and are career staff, but then we also have some folks that started as students, went into a student lead, and now are managers for us.
Do you engage at all with the campus food bank that is on campus, the campus pantry?
We do.
Are you engaged with that process?
Yeah. We do. And our we have a program where we do work with them and offer refrigeration and donations for them as well.
We're going to bring them in on a future show and talk about the campus pantry and that whole nutrition perspective of, you know, it goes all the way back to years ago, even during the civil rights and you know, individual rights in our communities in the 60s and 70s, that free and reduced lunches and breakfasts now all came about because the whole theory that if a student is not well fed and have good nutrition, a little guy in kindergarten and first grade is not going to know 2 + 2 or ABCs if they're hungry. And the same thing bodes well for the student at the University of Arizona. They have to have good nutrition in order for them to engage with that academic process.
Yeah, absolutely. We actually have a rooftop garden at the Student Union Memorial Center where we collaborate with College of Agriculture, and they harvest tomatoes, bell peppers, cucumbers, and those are all donated to the campus pantry. Anything that can't be used, we'll go ahead and produce in our production kitchen and use in our restaurants, but it's for the students that are attending the campus pantry.
Do you know if the county law has been changed yet? Like California, it has. I know. I'm not sure what it is here. So, like, for instance, when you have a big catering event and there's leftover food, are you allowed to donate that yet? Or does that not able to go to kitchens and so forth?
We are able to donate that, provided that it meets health codes as far as temperature and how long it's been sitting.
Right.
We do have a program called Boxing Up Hunger, where that food is blast chilled and portioned into single portions so that students can get that as well as at the campus pantry.
Excellent. When we come back after the break, we'll talk a little bit more about some exciting things that are going on and the future of technology in delivering food all across campus. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice. We'll be back after a few words from our great sponsors. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is Dr. Ed Ackerley. Today is the Wonder Day, where we talk about the good things going on at the University of Arizona. My co-host this morning is Sixto Molina. Good morning again, Sixto.
Good morning, Dr. Ed. Happy to be here.
With us is Christine Carlson. She's the Director of Dining and Nutrition at the University of Arizona Student Unions, serving almost 5 million meals, did you say a year?
A year.
That's a lot of meals that go out from the Student Union kitchens. Yeah. Yes. Amazing. Well, let's talk about a little bit about some of those venues that are available both in the Student Union and other satellite locations. You talked about 30 different restaurants, but tell us how those all came about and how you've varied the distribution of food, and instead of just all coming to a buffet where you walk down the line with your student tray like you did in high school, to all the cool things that have come about in the last few years.
Sure. So we do have 4 all you care to eat or cafeteria style locations available on campus. One of those is one that we just built out last year. It's called Radicchio. It is an all plant-forward dining location, so students have the opportunity to get vegetarian, vegan options. We also wanted to make sure we were accommodating students that have dietary requests there. So it is also a made-without-gluten facility, and it is free of peanuts and tree nuts. So that location alone has an extensive salad bar. It has pizza, which is a gluten-free crust or a cauliflower crust, and a rotating kind of international hotline available. And it also has awesome desserts. So that's just one of our all-you-care-to-eats. We also have several a la carte locations. Some of those are things like IQ Fresh that has wraps and smoothies. We have a location over at Global Center called Core Plus that is a dedicated gluten-free facility, offering things like quesadillas, rice noodle bowls, and salads.
That gluten-free is really important, especially to educate people about gluten-free, but also those students and faculty and staff that like to have a gluten-free diet for either medical reasons or even just health reasons. It's a good and important option for them.
Yes, absolutely. One of the projects that we did last summer is we created a small kind of a micro grocery store available on campus. So Highland Market is now known as Highland Grocery, and it offers a lot of fresh produce. It has an extensive bulk area, as well as grocery shopping opportunities for students so that they can take those items back to their dorm and prepare meals.
Do you work with student health services to work on the nutrition side of thing, to educate students about their healthy nutrition? And you know, they have a pretty robust program. Do you work with them in concert with them on that?
We do work with Campus Health to ensure that they're aware of the options that are available on campus for students that they are counseling. And then we also have dining and nutrition educators available through dining services for students that have dietary requests and need to understand what's available for them.
So we talk about serving students, obviously, every day. There's students even during the summer or during the winter break, during fall and spring classes. There's people at the University of Arizona all the time. Even if some of the students leave for a little while and then come back, you're still serving food basically every single day, depending on the situation. And that's a pretty daunting thing. You're like a restaurant open all the time, and you have to serve people.
That's right. And we really try and make sure that there's a good variety regardless of the number of students that are on campus. Obviously, summertime or winter closure, we do have a much lower census, but we do want to make sure that there's dining opportunities available for all.
For guys like Sixto and I, we enjoy going to, say, for instance, the president's tailgate party, right?
Yes, we do.
And we just kind of look at the food. We don't actually taste any of it, do we? We were laughing about.
I cannot tell a lie.
We were laughing about our nutritional habits, especially at, and we were talking about all the folks that takes. But that's just an example. The tailgate parties at the University of Arizona, the student union is involved quite heavily in many of those, and the president's tailgate party, wherever it would be, is part of what you do. And it's amazing how you go from a cafeteria style presentation or a grocery store, but then you also do catering and fine dining in the student union. I've been to a couple of events at the student union ballroom. Oh my goodness, it rivals anything that you would get at a major a five-star resort. So
yeah, we have a very talented team, and we can do all things from the cafeteria, like you mentioned, to fine dining, express catering, from picking up coffee and bagels to white linen service and an extensive China meal.
Right. Well, I want to talk about something really, I think, is just unique. When the first time you see it, you're just like, what is that? And these are these little vehicles, dining technology that delivers food from the student union over to different places on campus. You can tell us where they go, but the ones that I'm familiar with are ones that travel to the Honors College, and they go under the bridge, and they go across the street, and they go right down to the Honors College. The student gets their food and turns around and comes back. So tell us about that technology that goes into delivery of food in that unique way.
Yeah, so we got the Rovers probably 2 or 3 years ago, and we wanted to be able to find a way to deliver food to students across campus, still having the locations that we have open available to everyone, but a way to get food to other areas of campus. And so we started, I think, with probably 20 Rovers, and we're up to about 50 now. The students love them. We see people that stop and take selfies with them or are walking with them, kind of like a pet. And it's a lot of fun to watch. We were ranked last year number 2 in the nation for the number of deliveries that we were able to offer. We did over 50,000 in 1 year. And basically, students just order via mobile app. They select that they want delivery, and it's delivered to the ADA accessible door at whatever building that they're asking for delivery. So we deliver to the dorms. We deliver to any building on campus, essentially.
So they can go anywhere that a person can go. Then that little robot will go wherever they need to go to deliver that food.
That's right.
That's pretty
right.
Amazing. I will say that when you first see them, the first time you see them, it is an amazing experience. You like step back and go, what is that? And then someone kind of tells you what it is. But now that they've been on campus for, they're almost just like anything else, street furniture, whatever. People just kind of, it's just natural, except for when somebody new comes on campus and then the selfies start going on. And,
right.
And they are kind of cute, to be honest with you.
They are cute. They are. Their headlights are kind of look like eyes, and
yeah.
And they're a lot of fun. It's you can tell during move-in that students aren't really used to seeing those, and so that's a lot of fun for us to be able to offer those. It's a lot of fun to see them, you know, when there's five going at a time,
right.
And we'll watch the students that are loading them, and people will stop and take pictures of them just being loaded, so they're aware.
Are they, as they travel, this is the interesting question that I've been thinking about, as they travel from the student union to say that I see them going to the Honors College under the underpass there, is there a human being that is piloting those somewhere, or are they all 100% autonomous and do it by themselves?
They're autonomous, but they can be taken over by a human. Mm-hmm. So there's actually, you can check to see on a dashboard where they are at all times.
Right. Well, it's kind of interesting when they get to the street. So Helen Street is right there. Once they come out of the underpass by the McClelland Hall there by the Eller College, they stop there at the street. And it's like when we were in elementary school and there was a crossing patrol where you wait, and once the traffic, then you proceed with caution across, and they start their flashing lights so that if there was a car that came, they would see them. And it's amazing how amazing they can transgress through all sorts of different kinds of ramps and streets and sidewalks. It's amazing. It is fascinating to see when you have never seen them before. And when you take a moment, I happened to be parked in a car and was waiting for something, and I just kind of watched them, about 10 of them, do this thing, and it's amazing the technology behind it.
Absolutely, and it's kind of the last technology that we've added to all of our other technology, things like kiosks, mm-hmm. And the ability for pickup lockers across campus,
right.
where a student can order essentially from their math class and go to the locker, scan a code, a locker lights up. The door opens and they're able to pick up their food.
That's really convenient. That's fantastic.
I've got to ask this question. Do these robots have a name?
They have numbers. We haven't named them.
I mean, R2-D2 has a name.
Yeah, that would be a cute little thing to give them all little names.
That would be.
Which one is, that could be a fun little project for, to give them or have people adopt them. And they are cute as a button. And they're serving a purpose too. They're getting food to kids, and that's an important part of the convenience factor, which is amazing.
It's absolutely a convenience thing. And it was also a very nice thing during COVID, where if students weren't feeling well, it could be dropped, at that door so that they didn't have to go to a restaurant, even, you know, flu season, that type of thing,
right.
so that they can, you know, easily get food.
Right. That's amazing. Well, we're speaking with Christine Carlson. She's the Director of Dining and Nutrition at the University of Arizona Student Union's Memorial Center. Serving almost 5 million meals every year from that wonderful facility. And from small to how many people can fit in that large ballroom? 1,000 people maybe?
Probably. That's usually the Festival of Books dinner is
right.
in there, and that's usually about 900.
Yeah, it's amazing. I've been to that dinner, and it is amazing what you can get there. Well, that's really interesting. Thank you so much for joining us and telling us about all the good things that are going on for dining and nutrition, specifically nutrition. I think that's really important for students and parents who are listening, sending their kid down, that they're eating as well as they can. I'm sure there's times when they don't eat too well, but lots of them like to practice that good nutrition. So thank you for joining us this morning. So we're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI. You know, if you'd like to be interviewed on Jump in Tucson, check out jumpintucson.com. Maybe perhaps you or your organization, or if you're at the U of A, you might be interviewed live on Jump in Tucson. Thank you, Sixto, for being here this morning.
Thank you very much, Ed, for having me.
I think you and I ought to go down to the Student Union and check out some of those 30 restaurants. They have a new, what's it called, Cork and Craft. Cork and Craft, yeah. Which is a little bit of a bar. It's up our alley. They've got a few things, adult beverages there that we could partake in, which is kind of nice. I was there. That was where I went to the promotion party. It was
pretty
cool.
Yeah, it's a beautiful space.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Christine. Appreciate you being here today. And thank you all for listening to Jump in Tucson. We'll be back in just a minute with the second half. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI. Good morning again, and welcome to Jump in Tucson with the Wonder Edition, where we talk about the good things going on at the University of Arizona. Co-host this morning with me is Sixto Molina. Good morning again, Sixto.
Good morning, Dr. Ed. Glad to be here.
We've been doing lots of crazy things in the last couple of years, haven't we? It's kind of fun doing this radio show, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I never thought I'd be here, but here I am.
You're doing a great job. Well, with us for this section is Ladd Keith, and Ladd is an assistant professor of planning and sustainability built environments and is a faculty research associate at the Udall Center for Studies in Public Policy. Good morning, Ladd.
Yeah, good morning, Ed.
I haven't seen you in a while. By the way, I have to ask this of all students I've ever had. Who is your favorite teacher at the University of Arizona?
I think the answer has to be you, right, since I'm here.
I say something I shouldn't say. I say, well, I can always go back and change your grade. I really can't go back and change the grade, but it's great. So you were a student of mine many years ago, and we go way back as We know your family from years ago. So, Ladd, tell us a little bit about your journey to the getting a degree and another degree and coming to the University of Arizona. So tell us a little bit about your own personal educational journey.
Yeah, well, thanks so much, Ed. It's an honor to be here on your show. Like you said, you were one of my faculty members back during my undergraduate, but yeah. I'm actually from Tucson myself. Very few faculty are, right, because many come from other cities. But a three-time U of A graduate, like you mentioned, and for my master's, got a master's of science in planning, went on to be a planning practitioner, and was very interested in kind of what we can do to make Tucson a more livable place, kind of enhance the best qualities about it because it is such a special place, and fix the things that can be improved with it, right? And so have always been kind of environmentally minded myself. And at that time was serving as the City of Tucson's Planning Commission chair and worked on the general plan. And while we were working on that general plan, was very interested in incorporating kind of climate change, thinking about how we can make our city adapt to climate change. And at that time, most of the resources available to cities like us in the Southwest were actually focused on things like sea level rise and flooding. So mm-hmm. flooding, of course, pertinent to Tucson, but not so much sea level rise, right? Because
right.
we're a little bit further away from the ocean.
Not yet.
And so kind of looking at that was very interested in this idea that the fingerprint of climate change is literally increasing temperatures. Mm-hmm. Yet about 10 years ago, there were no resources available for cities or states or the federal government to actually deal with those temperatures. So that kind of shaped the PhD path that I took and the studies that I'm currently doing as an assistant professor of planning at the U of A.
Great. So you do teaching, but you also do research. And tell us a little bit about the Udall Center for Studies in Public Policy.
Yeah, so I have an appointment at the Udall Center as a faculty research associate. And the Udall Center is a really special place that's congressionally mandated. It's federally funded here at the University of Arizona, but it serves the nation. And it's kind of a very special place looking at environmental policy and governance and kind of brings together a lot of folks that work on very important issues in the Southwest and across the country related to those. So everything from water scarcity, the droughts that we're facing, things like that. And then, of course, with my involvement, looking at extreme heat, too.
So the Udall Center, when you hear the name Udall, you might think of, well, we would think of Udall Park in Tucson maybe, but people might think of Mo Udall, who was a representative for many years, actually ran for president of the United States back, I think, in the 80s. But this is actually named for Stuart Udall, right,
mm-hmm.
who was his
Correct.
Brother, who was the cabinet member that was in, what was his cabinet, what is that called, the Interior Cabinet, Department of the Interior, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's named after Stuart Udall, who was kind of a, maybe before his time, an environmentalist or a person who was looking at these long-range problems that our world was looking at and what the United States could do to, clean up water, clean up air. And maybe not back then when he was the Interior Department, but the whole concept of warming mm-hmm. as kind of more of a recent phenomenon. People have been talking about it for years, but it's more of a recent phenomenon. But it's interesting that, and he's a Southern Arizona guy, He and Morris grew up here in Southern Arizona.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why it's special that it's kind of one of the gems that we have at the U of A, even though it's federally funded again and kind of serves the whole nation. And it has two main branches. So one is the Environmental Policy Program. That's what I'm largely mm-hmm. Involved with. And then the Native Nations Institute, which is also situated there to really help support tribal communities across the country with different issues of governance.
With this appointment, you if you look at your resume and your CV, you do a lot of interviews with national and international news bureaus, CNN, BBC, other folks who are wanting to know about environmental policy. So you've done quite a few national, international interviews talking about these subjects, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And especially since I focus on heat, at the moment that the temperatures start to rise, we kind of see the number of those interview requests go up too. So,
as we've lived here in Tucson all of our lives, it's what they call it, when the ice breaks on the Santa Cruz and we get over 100 degrees. But we spend quite a few summers over the last 20, 30 years with the, 10, 15, 20, 30 days in a row with over 100 degrees. And so knowing what to do in the future and how to mitigate some of that with greenhouse gases and all that. So when you do public policy, you're advising governments then, or you're a think tank kind of to try and give policy recommendations to municipalities or states or even to the federal government? Is that what you're working on?
Yeah, that's a very accurate way of saying it. And so I would say my role specifically looking at heat is kind of advising on those types of issues and using the federally funded research programs that we have to help support decision making and kind of improve decision making.
Whether it's seeding clouds with grain so that they'll be more reflective of the sun's rays as we try to mitigate the 1,000 years worth of carbon monoxide and dioxide in the atmosphere, or whether we plant more trees like we were trying to do in Tucson in the area of planting a bunch more trees, which can absorb carbon and carbon dioxide and are a natural machine to try and mitigate some of that heating. It's all these things are all things that municipalities and governments can look at to try and mitigate heat, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's interesting because our situation here in Arizona, in Tucson, right, we've historically been hot. And so we grew up with the heat. It's nothing that any of us from Tucson are strangers with, right? But I think that on one hand kind of downplays the risk a little bit because it's just something that you live with and you grew up with and maybe don't see it so much as a threat. But also on the flip side of that, a lot of communities outside of Arizona are looking at what we're doing here in Tucson and Phoenix. And there's a lot of things that we do without even thinking of it or articulating it that are really adaptations to heat already that a lot of other places are trying to learn from. Mm-hmm. So I think that positions the University of Arizona kind of in an excellent position to help lead this area that's growing in heat policy planning and governance.
I can even remember back in the 70s or the 80s, we had some at Elkhorn Mall, we had some SunTran bus stops, and they had built these towers that were probably, maybe 50 feet high or whatever. And the idea behind them was that the air would go in the top and then the cool air would drop down.
Oh, yeah.
And it would cool the bus stop. You know, that was long before global warming was the topic of the day. And so we have done things to mitigate heat in Tucson. I would say another thing that many restaurants had for years and still do is, and maybe this is a little bit of squandering of natural resources, but the little sprayers that, evaporative cooling that happens. And we've had that for years.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you look at our traditional architecture, kind of the courtyards, a lot of the on the older buildings, the nice porch awnings that kind of extend over to block the sun.
And the direction that the livable space is faced.
Absolutely.
And so, north, south, as opposed maybe, especially west in the afternoons in the heat. So, yeah. You know, so
very, and a lot of advancements in recent years too. And so my kids who are in middle school and high school now, you know, all of the parks are shaded now. All
right.
Of their playgrounds have shaded
covers,
spots.
Covers
and
over the
when
top.
When you and I were growing up in Tucson, like maybe a little bit less shade. So I think we're making some improvements in those areas too.
Terra del Sol Park. Yeah, that's where I grew up. So, that's great. Well, we're talking with Ladd Keith, who is an assistant professor of planning and sustainable built environments and a faculty research associate at the Udall Center for Studies in Public Policy. We're talking about heat. And when we come back after the break, we'll talk a little bit about a new federally funded center that will rely on Ladd's expertise and other people at the University of Arizona to help communities manage extreme heat, and a fascinating discussion. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 The Voice, Tucson's only live local news and talk. We'll be back with the next segment talking about extreme heat and how we deal with it. Well, welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is Dr. Ed Ackerley. This is the Wonder Series where we talk about the good things going on at the University of Arizona. Co-host this morning is Sixto Molina. Good morning again, Sixto.
Good morning, Dr. Ed.
Well, thank you. And we're with Ladd Keith, who is an assistant professor of planning and sustainable built environments and a faculty research associate at the Udall Center for Studies in Public Policy. So, Sixto, you had a question about heat in Tucson specifically?
Yes, I'm concerned because in the city of Tucson and surrounding communities, we're building lots of roads and doing a lot of construction with concrete. So is there anything that can be done to mitigate the reflection of the heat from the roads and the concrete.
Yeah, absolutely. And the transportation system and roads are one of the biggest contributors to the urban heat island effect. So this idea that the way that we build and plan cities actually makes them hotter than the surrounding natural areas. And so the city of Tucson specifically has a new complete streets policy that's making sure that when we do expand roads or repave them, that they're the right size for the traffic that we need. So we're not like over planning for the roads. But then also doing pilot projects and looking at cool pavement products. And they are a little bit more expensive, of course, than traditional repaving, but they do have the ability to reflect some of that heat. And so we've actually at the University of Arizona partnered with them a few times to help measure the effect of those cool pavement products. And we're still kind of looking for the perfect one for Tucson, right? But I think the city's been very open and transparent about piloting them and then kind of looking at the results from those evaluation studies.
I have a similar question for you, and that is roofs on houses and buildings and so forth. Here in Tucson, a lot of the roofs are painted white with that synthetic or latex coating that's on the top of them. Does that help in heat mitigation, or is that increase the heat?
No, and actually that's one of our adaptations that I would say that we're kind of exporting to other places, right? So a lot of our houses already have the white roofs, and that's kind of being mandated or incentivized in other cities across the country. And even with even if you have a tile roof, whether it's a shingled tile or a cement tile, they now have reflective tiles essentially that are kind of a normal color, whether it's like a desert brown or something like that, that actually can still have higher reflective properties. So
the idea behind that is that if you have a dark surface like asphalt or something or a dark roof, that the sun's rays are coming down and they're being absorbed and that retaining that heat. But if you have a brighter surface, it'll actually reflect back out into the atmosphere unless there is CO2 up in the air that is trapping it back in. But the idea is to get it out into the atmosphere so that it's not being retained on Earth. Is that what it is?
Yeah, absolutely. And the side or co-benefit that we talk about with both of those would be with the houses is that if they're heating up less, right, due to those cool roofs, then we're using less air conditioning, and that waste heat that comes out of the air conditioning that ultimately contributes to climate change, but also that waste heat itself contributes to the urban heat island effect. So kind of it has the effect of cooling the house, but also reducing that waste heat from air conditioning.
And that would be sometimes like if the temperature in Tucson is, say, in the summertime is 110 degrees, it may only be 98 or whatever, and maybe in southern Arizona where there's a community where there's not so much concrete, not so much asphalt, not so much air conditioning going, blowing the hot air out. And so the urban center is hotter just because of all the activity and all the infrastructure that's there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say our Tucson urban heat profile isn't necessarily an island. So some of our coolest places are actually also our densest. So downtown has a lot of shade and a lot of greenery. The U of A's campus is one of the densest places in Tucson, but is also very green. So those are some of the cooler places. I'd say some of our hotspots are unfortunately the lower income communities, the south side of Tucson, that have a lot of built up concrete and asphalt and less vegetation. And so the city is using a lot of its resources to help kind of with the equity component to make sure that when we do these investments, we're increasing the greenery in the places that are currently the hottest.
Very interesting. Let's talk a little bit about the new federally funded center that will rely on your expertise and those folks down to work with you to help other communities. So it's a $2.25 million grant from the federal government, of which the U of A just gets a small portion of that. But tell us a little bit about that that program and your involvement in that.
Yeah, and so the context behind this all, right, to give a little bit of context is, again, heat as a hazard is something that we've been looking at less seriously, I would say, than other climate risks. And so we've been doing drought planning in the United States since the 1930s, flood planning seriously with the floodplain mapping and everything since the 50s and 60s, wildfire management for, decades as well. Mm-hmm. But if you look at heat, it's the number one weather-related killer in the United States, but we only devote a small amount of resources to actually addressing it. Here in Arizona, our heat deaths increased 50% last year to almost 1,000, and that's almost the same number of folks that die from preventable deaths like homicides or car crashes. And so if you look at all the resources we put into preventing car crashes and homicides in Arizona and what we're doing to prevent heat deaths, kind of a huge disparity there too. So this idea with this exciting new center is it's funded by the National Integrated Heat Health Information System, NIHIS, because the federal government loves its acronyms, right?
Exactly.
But it is called the Center for Heat Resilient Communities. And the idea here is that it's a partnership between UCLA, the U of A, and ASU, but we're serving the entire nation and translating a lot of research that we've been doing, a lot of best practices that are out there into guidance for local communities. And we'll be serving a cohort initially over the first 3 years of the center of a cohort of 30 communities. And we'll also be turning that that guidance back that we, and those lessons that we learn from the communities, will be providing the federal government with guidance essentially on how they can better serve the United States and all of our residents and community members to address extreme heat.
This is an excellent example of the wonder that goes on at the U of A, of how local people working at the U of A are doing research and making recommendations for municipalities across the country and bettering their lives and making them their places a little safer to live in and more heat resistant or whatever we're doing. And that's what Jump in Tucson is all about, is honoring these things about wonder. I do want to ask you a little bit about your so this project's a little bit smaller, but you are working on a $25 million project as well. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we have a couple of other larger federally funded research programs at the U of A that I'm on the leadership of. One of them is the Department of Energy funded Southwest Urban Corridor Integrated Field Laboratory. So we call it the Southwest IFL for short. Again, love our acronyms.
Another acronym, right?
And federal government and academia. But the Southwest IFL is a partnership between ASU, the U of A, and NAU, and a few other national laboratories and IBM. And essentially, we're looking at the whole Arizona urban corridor from the Navajo Nation through Flagstaff, the Phoenix metropolitan area, Tucson, down to Nogales. And we're looking at climate change impacts related to extreme heat and air quality. And so doing a lot of really sophisticated climate change modeling, creating a digital twin of the urban corridor, looking at doing field work, so on-the-ground observations. And then the part that I'm largely in charge of is looking at how to translate all of that into, again, practical advice for communities to use this information with.
I have just curiosity. Are you doing new research, or are you taking existing data and using it for your purposes? Are you going out and doing actual studies and so forth, or are you taking the existing data that's already there?
Yeah, that's a great question. So with the first center that we were talking about, the Center for Heat Resilient Communities, that's largely a translational center. So kind of taking existing resources, we will be producing, right, you know, new guidance from it. The Southwest IFL is all about creating new information and kind of developing new information from the state. And so as an example, this summer, we will be deploying teams of researchers. We have some really cool climate trucks that one of the national labs is providing. They'll actually be coming to Tucson in June or July, and we'll be spending a week or two kind of doing on-the-ground observation work across the whole metropolitan area. So you may see us out there with climate trucks and weather balloons and such, and really trying to fill in some of the gaps of understanding about the urban heat island that we were just talking about.
Great. Well, Sixto and I can be part of your research team. When we're out playing golf, we can say, boy, it's hot out here, middle of summer, and it's hot in Tucson. So we can verify that it's hot. Well, Ladd Key, thank you so much for joining us on Jump in Tucson and all the great work you're doing about mitigating heat and managing extreme heat for not only Tucson, but the state and also the nation. Thank you, Sixto, for joining us on Jump in Tucson. You're a great co-host. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice, Tucson's only live local news and talk station. If you're interested in being interviewed either on the Friday show to share success stories about your organization or business, or if you're at the U of A and want to talk about something great happening at the U of A that the listeners should know about, give us a call or contact us at jumpintucson.com. Have a great week. We'll see you here on Friday. This is Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice.